Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The annual Black Hat Conference, wrapping up today in Las Vegas, has been described as Disney World for hackers. Big presentations this year on hacking your way into hotel rooms, hacking your way into your electric smart meter, and more. The thing is, security experts are here too, and law enforcement, all rubbing shoulders and exchanging information and hiring each other. This hour on Point, hackers, Black Hat, and cybersecurity now. You can join the conversation. What's your perception of hackers? Are they criminals, cyber terrorists, or could they be the good guys exposing security holes before they're taken advantage of? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from the Palazzo Hotel in Las Vegas is Jordan Robertson. He is a reporter who covers tech for Bloomberg News in Vegas for the Black Hat Conference. Jordan Robertson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Wade. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Jordan, you're a grizzled veteran of Black Hat conferences. How's this one been?
Well, this one's great, Wade. You know, every year you see attendance grow, you see the number of media and reporters grow, and you see the hacks being presented, get better and get scarier in some cases.
And, you know, what has stood out to you this year?
There are a couple of things that have stood out this year. Obviously, there's a smart meter talk that you're going to have the researcher on later, I understand, and that's a really interesting one. As you mentioned earlier, there was some near-field communication research, and that's kind of the new method for paying for things with your smartphone. That's opened up a new attack vector for hackers. I've posted a story this morning about Facebook expanding a kind of a bug bounty program it has to vulnerabilities on its own network, so it will be paying hackers to try to break into its own internal network now, which is a big shift. And so there's critical infrastructure attacks, things like that, air traffic control issues. It really runs the gamut. There's a lot of interesting research going on this year, and a lot of it involves physical infrastructure, which is kind of a new trend that's been happening over the past few years.
Physical infrastructure meaning what?
Well, physical infrastructure from hotel room key readers, as you mentioned earlier, but also critical infrastructure such as power grids, water systems, things like that. It's physical infrastructure is increasingly being connected to computer networks, and Microsoft Windows machines are running, let's say, the systems that control whether dams and things like that. So as those systems get connected to the internet, vulnerabilities are being discovered, and hackers are toying with them to see if there are vulnerabilities that could cause damage.
You know, Vegas is often home to these big tech conferences that, tens of thousands of people come in. The displays go on for miles. Is this a different crowd?
It is a different crowd. This is I like to think of this as kind of the Super Bowl for hackers. I mean, the point of Black Hat is twofold. One, it's a platform for research. So if you're a security researcher, and hacker and security researcher in many cases now mean the same thing. These are guys who are paid to do vulnerability research for companies, and they show up, and if they've got some hot new research, and if they can get it into the Black Hat research track, you can become a star off that research. And I've seen that happen over my years covering this conference. If you've got some good research and it's significant and it has some sweep to it, you can become a really famous security researcher here. So yes, there are lots of those guys. There are lots of vendors as well. Black Hat is an industry conference, so there are industry sponsors. So there are a lot of guys, and it's mostly men, but there are some women selling security technologies. So there are those two crowds, and it's not so much product demonstrations as it is security professionals, IT administrators for organizations, network administrators, things like that. But it is many, many people all here to learn about the latest security technologies.
Now, I know exactly what hackers look like because I've seen them on TV and in the movies. They're pudgy and they're pasty face and they eat a lot of chips and they stay in dark rooms surrounded by, dozens of monitors, right?
Well, that's certainly true in some cases, but then there are other folks as well who are who would look just like the IT administrator kind of down the hall. There are a lot of folks from the military as well in security research. The researcher you're going to have on later, Don Weber, is a Marine. So there are folks that don't kind of fit the mold of what a traditional hacker looks like. However, that being said, there are a lot of folks that would look like that may look like somebody out of the movies as well.
Well, speaking of the devil, let's bring Don Weber in. He is in Vegas at Caesar's Palace, and he's a security expert at the InGuardian Security Consultancy. He presented at Black Hat yesterday on the way to hack into electric smart meters. That's the new kind of meters on the side of your house that monitor and communicate your power usage, I think using radio frequency. Don Weber, thanks for joining us.
Oh, Wade, thank you.
Tell us, I know that you had your presentation yesterday. How did that go?
Actually, the presentation went very well. The reception was really good. We had a full room. We got a lot of really good questions to ask about to help people understand exactly what I was talking about, not only from the crowd but also from the media. So hopefully we're sending the right message that tells everybody that although we're doing vulnerability research just regular research on these meters and potentially finding vulnerabilities, it's the same type of vulnerabilities we would find in anything. But the really good thing is that the vendors, the smart meter vendors, the utilities, they have methods of identifying when people are attacking these things. And that's one of the things that we were able to do with our research is we were able to show them how it would look when these types of things happen. So that's why we were excited about giving this talk today.
Well, my utility came in and put one of these things on my house, and I don't know how much I knew about it, but I think a little bit in the back of my mind I wondered, is this thing going to be secure? Can you pull info you're not supposed to, or can you use what you know as an attack tool?
That's one of the things we're trying to help people understand a little bit better. A lot of the tools that the vendors provide to the utilities are specifically for reconfiguring the meter, for obtaining the information that they need as well. And they don't have tools to help them understand what it might look if somebody tried to log in 1,000 times, or if somebody tried to make a configuration change. Configuration change would potentially give you electricity at a reduced rate or even free electricity. And what we're able to show is that in some situations, depending on the software that they've deployed, the solution that they've implemented, that they can detect those changes and respond to them properly.
Now, I don't want free electricity, but I live in Dallas, and if you saw my electric bill in the summertime, it would make you weep. My self-interest in this is what can I do to hack into my electric meter and bring that bill, down from 600 to, say, 150?
And we did not show people how to do that. And actually, I get that
question. I kind of thought that might be the case.
Yes, sir. I actually get that question a lot when I start. When people ask me what I'm doing, one of the things that they say is, can you get me free electricity? We show them we can make modifications. I actually don't know enough about the meters, and actually each meter is different. So I could eventually build that into the tools that we're releasing for assessments.
Excellent.
But it's not necessarily anything I need to show. I just need to show I can make modifications and then show them how to detect that.
I have prepared myself for the disappointment. When you first tried to present, I know the utility companies got nervous and pulled the plug. Tell us that story.
Yes, sir. Before we presented, we were going to present at another conference called SmooCon in D.C., and it's a very good conference. A lot of security professionals go there, so we felt we were going to get some good word out. But we prepared before going to the conference by providing our presentation, providing our tool to many vendors, many utilities, asked for their feedback, and we got wonderful feedback. So we felt good about moving forward with it. We didn't think we'd get a call, but at the last second we did get a call. Somebody didn't understand what we were doing, and so we pulled back, and we talked to them, and we've been talking to them for 6 months. We didn't get a phone call at the last minute this time, so obviously we've helped them understand what we're doing.
Do these meters use radio frequency? How does this work?
Well, it depends on the radio, but all of them are connected to the back-end resources so that they can remotely manage them, and it makes it more cost-effective so they don't have to send a person and what they call roll a truck. So they don't have to roll a truck every single time they need to make a change or check configuration. Or gather data. So it's it speaks over either a cellular network or a radio network back to the back end, and that's one of the things we'll be looking at into the future.
How long did it take you to do this, and how are you going to make money?
I'm not sure I understand really the last part. We provide security services continuously. Smart meter deployments aren't just the smart meter on the side of your house. They're actually a part of an advanced metering infrastructure, AMI, and we provide utilities who call us up with services to understand not only how the smart meters are working, but all the way to the back end, checking the network interfaces, checking the databases and the web servers for potential problems and configuration errors and so forth. So we help the utilities with the gambit.
Is this going anywhere else? Do we expect to see more of these kinds of devices doing different kinds of things?
The things that the smart meters are doing right now, it's going to be fairly consistent, but what's going to happen is through our research, through research of other security companies, and through the development of through the research of their own development teams, the smart meters themselves are going to get much more secure. They're already taking these things into consideration.
Great.
That's one of the things our tool helps them do.
Thank Don Weber. Thank you for joining us. Don Weber is a security expert at the NGuardian Security Consultancy. Don, thanks so much.
Thanks, sir.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're joined this hour by Jordan Robertson, reporter for Bloomberg News. He's in Las Vegas covering the Black Hat Conference. I'd like to bring in a couple of more voices. Joining us from Houston is Michael Gregg, a computer security specialist and chief operating officer of Superior Solutions, a cybersecurity company, and he calls himself an ethical hacker. Michael Gregg, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Wade.
Also with us from Bloomington, Indiana, is Fred Kate, director of the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. Fred Kate, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Wade.
Michael, why is this Black Hat Conference important?
Well, I think this is important because for one reason, just what was mentioned earlier about all these devices that are now connected to the Internet. We're talking about the power grid, 911 systems, nuclear power plants. These can have a huge impact on cybersecurity if the security controls aren't put in place.
Hacking into hotel rooms got my attention. I think that the moment we moved from real keys to plastic cards, I thought to myself, really? This is secure? And then, of course, like every other dummy, I just thought they must know what they're doing and put it out of my mind. But hotel key is a rather serious problem. What's going on here?
Yeah, one of the things in the presentation that was discussed was how easy it actually is maybe to go down to Radio Shack and buy about $20 worth of gear and then potentially connect to the door itself through the plug that's in the front of the door and extract either the key number or extract a master key number. And the scary thing is the hotel actually has a master key number that someone at the hotel would have. So what was discussed in the presentation is someone could use that key number, access your room, and then if someone was murdered or shot in the room and the police went back and looked to see who accessed the door, it would show that it was someone in the hotel with access. So then they'd have to go to cameras or other means to try to prove or disprove that one individual on duty did or did not access your room.
Fred, we used to be focused on big devices, computers and laptops. but increasingly we're moving away from that to smaller devices.
That's exactly right, Wade. And those small devices are, you know, pretty critical to our lives. We almost all live with some sort of smartphone in our hands. But they're also incredibly difficult to protect, both because they we don't want to slow them down by running good virus and protection, and also because we use them in so many different settings, we really don't know who we're connecting to with them.
Well, I mean, like, I'll go to a restaurant now, and I'll hand them my credit card, and they have a device on their hip that they slide my credit card through and hand it back to me. And I thought, wow, that's cool. That really speeds things up. But I guess this also makes my credit card and myself more vulnerable.
Well, I think that's true. And, of course, increasingly you're going to go to that restaurant and you're just going to use an app on your cell phone to pay for the meal. And what that app is connecting to, what information it's conveying, and whether it's being hijacked along the way is going to make the information even more vulnerable.
You see this, like, you could drive up and get gasoline now, and I'll wave a little key at the gas pump, and bing, I've paid for my gasoline. And I see that in 7-Elevens and other sorts of convenience stores, they're trying to make my stay in there as quick as possible and get me out of the store as fast as possible. Often that means I'm not going to open my wallet anymore.
Well, that's right. And of course, the U.S. government has done this with RFID chips in passports so that when you show up at the border, no longer do they have to scan your passport. You can literally just wave it across an RFID chip reader.
So what kinds of vulnerabilities do these devices present for us?
Well, it depends on the device, but you always have the vulnerability, first of all, that the data is being intercepted or collected by someone you don't want to have the data. So whether that's your credit card number or whether that's your passport number, that somebody else is getting the data. When you're using an electronic device like a cell phone, you always have the risk that they're introducing something else into your cell phone. So, for example, they would introduce a virus into your phone that would give them access to even more data or would give them the ability to turn on, for example, your cell phone microphone or your cell phone camera at times of their choosing rather than your choosing. And then there's also this sort of, you know, broader problem, and I think Jordan used the term physical infrastructure, and I think this is really the critical point, which is not only are we generating a lot of data when we know we are, when we're standing with a cell phone in our hands or we're using a computer, but also we're using a lot of these electrical computing devices when we have no idea that we are. And again, the door lock is a good example. The 2 to 3 dozen computers in the average American car are a good example. The number of computers we use to control critical infrastructure, utilities, aircraft, and the like, all of these become vulnerable because they're all interconnected with each other.
Michael, I think that the makers of these devices have won the day, though. I mean, we users, we go about using them and we feel secure. We think it's going to work.
Well, I think there's really two points to bring home for this. One is technology always races ahead of security. If we look in the past and we use the past as a judge for the future, be it Bluetooth, cell phone communication, we even look at RFID, generally this technology races ahead. And then the security researchers come out and find problems with security mechanisms, and then we come back and try to build these security mechanisms in. Also, the other point as far as how invasive this technology is around us, take maybe for last week as an example, there was some employees at a Burger King, and they had taken a picture of someone standing on buckets of lettuce. I don't know if anybody remembers seeing that. And they posted this on the web. Well, I don't know if they realized this or not, but the geodata inside of the photograph or the image allowed people to almost instantly get the location and coordinates of where that picture was taken, track it down to that actual Burger King, and those individuals were fired the same day.
My goodness. let's take a caller. Andrew is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi, Wade. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
This has been a great thing having hackers. I think they are the equivalent of the press with our relationship to the government. They look out and keep an eye on corporations and people who are sometimes trying to do the right thing, but sometimes let things slip. I mean, there have been security holes found in a variety of websites and applications, and hackers have done a great job of, like, looking out for us. And I think they've also kept people aware of security. I mean, most people who have wireless access points in their house now have security on them because they realize that the threat is out there. I think they do an invaluable service.
Well, they certainly have a lousy reputation because I think because email accounts get hacked or your Facebook account gets hacked and hackers use them to email advertisements out to everybody that's in your address book. And you think, you know, hacker. It's quite a conundrum when you think about how the public thinks about hackers. Fred?
Well, I think hackers come in all shapes and sizes, and one of the big developments we've seen over the past 30 years or so has been hackers going mainstream, if you will. And so you mentioned earlier the Facebook bug bounty, but you know, Google has announced a $1 million set of prizes for anyone who can hack into its operating system, Chrome. Microsoft last year created the Blue Hat Prize, taking a takeoff of the name Black Hat, but again, offering bounties for people who can break into its system. So these are all examples of, I think, what we call ethical hacking, where we're trying to use hackers for good purposes. But we have to remember there are all sorts of other types of hackers out there as well, including you know, the hackers who, you know, I typically describe as the kids who do it for kicks rather than they're necessarily trying to make money or cause harm. We also have a lot of very unsophisticated hacking. So it actually turns out that the large majority of phishing emails we see, the large majority of viruses we see are actually made available by literally using things you can purchase on the internet. So one creative person created these things, but then is effectively marketing it so that hundreds of thousands or even millions of others can use these things to create viruses or attacks of their own. And this is, of course, another activity altogether.
Michael, I've learned that there are three types of hackers: white hats, black hats, and gray hats. Are there 50 shades of gray hats?
Well, really, yeah, it kind of breaks down to the three. Generally, black hats are thought of people that do these things for malicious purpose, things like build crimeware kits or build these viruses or different types of malware that we've been talking about. And you have white hats that are thought of as the security professionals, people that go to things generally like Black Hat and other security conferences. Then you have the gray hats. The gray hats are the people that are kind of in between. I think of them as Luke, maybe on Star Wars, because generally they want to do the right thing, but they have Darth Vader on the other side kind of saying, Luke, come to me. And they're kind of being pulled over to the dark side. So generally they're good people, but they may go to one side or the other and do things that would break the law.
Are they pulled to the dark side because that's where the better information is?
I don't know if it's that. I think part of it is just the thrill of it. I think for some people it's thrill, the thrill of being able to get in a network or do something. For others, it could be monetary gain. And for some others, it's simply the thing of saying, look at me. You know, back in 2000, we had an individual in Canada named Mafia Boy, and he hacked in and actually launched a huge denial of service against eBay, Amazon, and others. And almost immediately, he'd, you know, gone on the web and said, look at me. Look what I can do. I'm not a script kiddie. I'm actually an elite hacker because I'm, you know, one of the best. So sometimes it's simply for bragging rights.
What's a script kiddie?
A script kiddie is simply someone who finds a script or a piece of code, like we've been talking about, that someone else has made on the web. They don't actually understand how it works, but they know how to plug in the values or numbers and use it in an attack.
Jordan, increasingly the hacking community is joining forces with the security community. Are hackers okay with this? Don't hackers have an instinct to be wary of authority?
No, it's an interesting point because you know, hackers generally start off toying with these technologies because they're interested in them. And as Michael and Fred have pointed out, you know, the intention may be fairly benign to start with. But once you find a bug, the question becomes, well, what do you do with it? So if you find a bug in a Microsoft product, well, do you contact Microsoft? Probably. If you find a bug in a piece of critical infrastructure, well, who do you even call? And that's the question now is, well, how do hackers work with the government, work with the formal security community, and the partnership has actually been quite nice. I mean, over the years that I've covered this stuff, I've seen a lot of hackers who may have been independent folks who did this for fun or recreation have gone on to really nice computer security jobs. So these are folks with 401ks and stock options and things like that, and there is a strong pull toward doing this stuff for good. And as Fred and Michael mentioned, there is being a hacker doesn't necessarily mean that you have evil intentions. You may just be a technologist who enjoys looking at computers for fun. The question becomes, how do you use that? How do you monetize it? And there's been a lot of interest among hackers in working with government, working with security consultancies, because at the end of the day, a lot of these guys want to make products more secure. Sometimes they run into infrastructure problems of how do we go about doing that? And that's a bigger question, because the proper avenue for disclosing vulnerabilities and telling the right people don't always exist.
Fred, I think you had a student who pointed out holes in the TSA systems.
Yes, that's exactly right. A graduate student here at Indiana University. And I think it suggests to some extent the transition we've seen over the past decade, because when he pointed this out 6 or 7 years ago now, the FBI showed up at his door and immediately he was treated as the bad guy, even though what he was doing was illuminating a hole in what the government itself was doing. Now, in these days, I think you would find those sorts of people are being hired as consultants by the government. They're being used by the government to try to draw on their talents, because at the end of the day, the government ought to want to patch those holes, not track down and punish the people who discovered them, provided they didn't also exploit them for some evil purpose.
Let's take a caller. Cynthia's calling in from Arlington, Vermont. Cynthia, hello.
Hi, Wade.
Hello.
Yes, hi. I called because in Vermont, the utilities are deploying a wireless smart meter system. And in Vermont, we have the chance to opt out of the system without a fee. And I think that the fact that they are deploying these wireless systems without having to dealt with the security issues ahead of time is outrageous. We don't have a choice with the utility. It's a monopoly. It's not a question of how you pay for gas. And I think that the previous presentation that you had showed that the software and the wireless systems will be vulnerable to hacking, hackers who could obtain data, who could change bills, who possibly in the future could turn on and off your appliances, which has a whole bunch of security issues. So I think that from the perspective of a customer and a ratepayer, it is outrageous that such systems are deployed before the security issues are dealt with. We become guinea pigs. And I think it's very important that Vermonters know that they can opt out of that wireless smart meter system.
Thank you, Cynthia. Fred, is Cynthia right to be wary?
Yes, I think she's exactly right to be wary. And I think she, you know, points out, I think Michael mentioned it as well, and that is, you know, we always see the deployment of new technologies, new products, new systems before the security issues are dealt with thoroughly. So there's a rush to market, if you will, because these will save money for the companies bringing them out. They may generate additional revenue. And I think what we would like to see is a more sort of thoughtful approach that would say, look, you don't have to bog this down forever, but some solid testing, invite the hackers to look at it before it goes public, and then implement appropriate changes before you have critical data on it or you're controlling critical systems where real people can be injured if we don't get it right.
Michael, do you agree?
Oh, I agree most definitely. And I think earlier you mentioned the point about getting free power. What would concern me more is someone being able to turn the power off. Because think about it from a 9/11 perspective, from an attacker perspective, being able to turn off the electrical power in an area, in a state, or an entire country. So if the U.S. got ready to go to war with someone, they could potentially turn off the power in the U.S. in a large area and say, do you really want to do this, or is this something you're really interested in? And I think the other point that needs to be thought about is even sometimes these devices, meaning the hardware itself, is purchased from overseas or from other countries, and we don't always know what may potentially even be in these chips or in the firmware, that there might be backdoors or other controls placed in those.
Well, you know, when I'm not sitting in this chair, I'm a reporter, and I'm often deployed to hurricanes or horrible tornadoes, and in addition to the destruction, the lack of electricity, it just breaks people's spirit, and it breaks people's spirit pretty quickly, a matter of a few days or weeks, and they're very unhappy. Jordan, Michael, Fred, stay with us. We're discussing the Black Hat Conference, Hacking in the New Face of Cybersecurity. I'm Wade Goodwin, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're joined this hour by Jordan Robertson, reporter for Bloomberg News. He's in Las Vegas covering the Black Hat Conference. Also by Michael Gregg, security expert and ethical hacker. And by Fred Kate, director of the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. I just ask a question. Given the chance, would you consult with a hacker on how to make it safer? I think for the most of us out there, the consumers, we feel pretty helpless. Is there much that we can do? Michael, let me ask you.
Well, I think so, and I think that's really the big overall question that we're looking at, is because with events such as Black Hat, and that Fred mentioned earlier, has been this ongoing debate over the years, is when problems are found, are security professionals doing the right thing by releasing these? Or should they not release these? And I think Jordan mentioned earlier about, sometimes presentations being suppressed, that companies not wanting them out there. And I think that's where companies like Facebook and others are doing the right thing, where Facebook actually comes in and says, you know what, if you can hack our site and you tell us how you did this and show us what you did, we'll actually pay you for this. So they're actually paying people up front to find these problems before the real hackers or before the black hats can.
This is not all that different from the weaponized bird flu virus, where they found scientists found a way to make it more communicable, and there was a lot of anxiety about putting this information out there. If I'm a hacker and I've discovered, let's say, a new way to shut down electricity to the East Coast, should I keep this to myself, or is this something I need to speak up about? What are the politics of this? Fred, how about you take a stab at that?
Well, I think we've seen a tremendous emergence of this field called ethical hacking. And I think you would find today that most computer science departments, most informatics schools across the country even teach courses in it. So the whole idea is to go after to find the holes, to find the problems, to unearth the difficulties, but to do so in a way that doesn't immediately make those exploitable, so that you notify the company or you notify the party who can fix it first before you go public with it, and you give them a reasonable amount of time to try to fix it, to come up with a fix and to deploy that fix. The problem is, for many years, many companies have been very resistant to that. They didn't want to find out this information. There may have been legal issues involved, that they would have greater liability if they knew of the flaw in their product, but they still didn't fix it. I think that has changed significantly among the sort of industry leaders in the field, but I think we would find that it's still true among a number of companies that are deploying technologies they don't really understand, but that they think will save them money or help them generate additional revenue. If I can just add one other point, you asked earlier about what can individuals do, or is there anything individuals can do? And I think it's absolutely true that the majority of what can be done needs to be done institutionally. It needs to be done by the people who control the infrastructure, people who develop the technologies and so forth. But that doesn't mean that individuals are helpless. And one of the things that we see a lot of, which is, I think, disappointing to all of us, is the really dumb things that we all do. You know, we don't use strong passwords. We keep the same password. We use it across multiple accounts. And we've seen in a lot of these breaches recently, including several this year, where password systems are breached and there's somebody posts the passwords online, it gives researchers a chance to see what are people using for passwords. And it's absolutely astonishing the number of people who are still using their address, their phone number, 5 ones or 5 zeros in a row. And when individuals do that, there is nothing that industry can do to protect us from ourselves. So even though our role is small, it is absolutely critical.
Michael, do you agree with Fred about, you know, let's go public when we find these things? Is there a danger of having a black hat have a light bulb go on if you learn something and think, now I can use this to do this?
Well, I think generally the problem is already that the people that are really black hats and a lot of the cybercrime and cyber espionage that we see going on, we read about in the news almost on a daily basis, those folks already know about this. I think the ethical thing to do is to try to work with the vendor directly first, as Fred had mentioned, and actually work with them and then come out with the findings after they've had a chance to address these problems or to make changes. But for far too long, as I mentioned earlier, if I believe in many technologies, we've kind of lived by this security by obscurity. So we have things like you mentioned, like pacemakers, that you could literally connect to, or an insulin pump, and control it. And there's no security controls put in place because someone says, you know, why would anyone even want to do that? Or we think of such things as maybe Bluetooth in your car, or the ability to connect by a cell phone to your car, and that someone could also potentially use that to disable your car, turn it off. So I believe that's true. And the other good point that Fred brought up was people on an individual basis have to take responsibility for security. Because, for example, when LinkedIn was broken into, they showed the results that the most common password used was the word link, L-I-N-K. And for Yahoo, one of the most common ones was password, and the other one was QWERTY. So on an individual basis, we have to use good passwords. We have to use passwords that aren't based on names or on pet names. And we can't use passwords on more than one site, meaning the same password. You got to change those up.
Lots of telecommunications companies are now in China. Is this dangerous? Could they be building in back doors, kill switches? I've heard rumors that, you know, China could kill the internet. Is this all hyperbole, or is there real concern here? Fred?
Well, I think the honest answer is we don't know. So there's a huge amount of talk about this, and there's some very well-placed people from government and industry who have made this point. I think what we can safely say that we do know is, first of all, the majority of our equipment is made in China, including the majority of the switches on the internet, the majority of the devices that connect to the internet. And we also know there are attacks that originate from China on a very frequent basis, thousands per minute, that attack critical infrastructure in the United States, including Defense Department websites, NSA websites and facilities. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a plot, if you will, or that it's an organized effort by the Chinese government. It may just mean China's a huge place and has a less regulated culture than in the United States. And China's certainly not the only source of these attacks. But whether there's more going on, I, for one, at least can't really say.
Reed is calling from Newberry, New Hampshire. Reed, hello.
Hi, Wade. Thank you for hosting this most interesting and fascinating discussion.
It's my pleasure.
I would like to hear a little more about the particularly interesting things going on with information technology and healthcare, where federal tax dollars are being used to massively subsidize the uptake of information technology, and the incentives that are being provided for that do not actually have sanctions attached to them on the back end. So in essence, the federal government is driving these installations well in advance of privacy and security protections being rigorous in that space. So I'd like to hear a bit more about the particular concerns of non-security in some of our most personal information.
Michael, we're talking about electronic medical records.
Well, I can just tell you personally that for me, I remember in the old days growing up when you'd go in the doctor's office and look behind the doctor's and the nurse's workstation and you'd see all these records, these paper documents. And now much of that is kept electronically. And my fear would be that the appropriate controls are not placed on that information, that literally someone could access this and access potentially your medical records, other types of PII. I'd be quite concerned on this.
Douglas is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Douglas, hello.
Hello, Wade.
Gus, yes, go ahead.
Earlier, one of the people was talking about contacting the right people in order to get a security problem fixed. I was a state voting system examiner for the state of Iowa back in the 90s. And in the late 90s, I found a serious security flaw in one of the voting systems brought before us. The vice president of development for the voting system company was there making the presentation about the system they were trying to sell the state of Iowa. And I told him, look, you can't go to market with this until you fix this problem. And I explained the problem, I thought, pretty clearly, and I gave him a book that he should read, and his developers should read, to try to get things right. Nothing happened. It was only 5 years later, after some seriously ethical hackers got a hold of the source code of the voting system and began reverse engineering things, that this came to light again. And it was clear by that point that the company had done literally nothing in 5 years to fix the security problem. It's only when the hacking community exposes something and makes it public that there seems to be any response. And so my feeling is that if it weren't for the threat of public disclosure of these security flaws, most of industry wouldn't do anything about them.
Willful ignorance. Michael Gregg?
I agree with you 100% that's one of the key roles that ethical hackers play, is bringing these items to light in much the same way a reporter would. And returning to your point from earlier about devices and telecommunications devices, we've seen this brought up a couple of different times about companies such as Huawei and ZTE, because they are now capturing large amounts of the telecommunications infrastructure business. And so far, they've been blocked in countries such as Australia, India, and also in the U.S. And part of that fear really is that in these devices, as we were talking about earlier, is that they might potentially build backdoors into this equipment that could allow them to potentially intercept communication, could allow them maybe to change communication, or could potentially allow them to disrupt communication. Now, I agree with Fred. To do all this would be quite complicated, but we have seen studies earlier this year that shown at the very core of these devices, in the firmware and chips, they have the ability to build in backdoors, meaning that could be built in during the manufacturing process. Now, part of this could be hyped up because it's an election year. Part of it could be hyped up because there's U.S. companies that, you know, sell the same products that these guys do. So we're trying to favor U.S. companies. But part of it could be that there's a real threat from this. That's why I think any device, be it a voting device, a smart meter, or what we use for telecommunications, and to hear this radio broadcast today, is secure and is there valid before it's actually released.
Is it seriously possible that I could steal the election in Florida and Pennsylvania by rigging the machines?
Well, that's been brought up. I mean, that's definitely been an issue that's been brought up several times with some of these electronic devices, that they have been found to have some vulnerabilities.
Let's take a caller. Terry is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Terry, welcome to the program.
Hello, Wade. I work for the state of Tennessee, and we recently had a gray hat experience with one of our school districts in the state of Tennessee, who received a warning from a gray hat who said that, you know, he was found some vulnerabilities in their education data system that included data about their personnel and students in the school district. And he gave a very sound warning, tried to get taken seriously, wasn't taken seriously, and then released that data. So, and it really has made folks in the education data community stand up and take notice. So I appreciate the work of the gray hats out there.
Thank you so much. Bill is calling from Lincoln, Illinois. Bill, hello.
Hello. I missed part of my first half of your radio show, so if you've covered the subject, forgive me. But on the subject of the hacktivist group Anonymous, authorities in the media tend to kind of portray them as very negative, almost in a terroristic point of view, but it seems to me that they were able to bring to light not just security vulnerabilities, but some ethical vulnerabilities, like with the NDAA, with SOPA, with some of these laws. They were able to put that information out there and spark a public debate that was beforehand virtually non-existent. So what are your guests' feelings on them in general?
We have not talked about this. Fred?
Well, you know, it's something we have a long and proud tradition of in the press and under the protection of the First Amendment, and that is, you know, very often the press makes public things that the government or industry would rather not have public. So when Anonymous does it, the question is, what's different? In other words, should we view them the same way? Should we recognize that there's some differences? For example, the press usually operates under some ethical standards. Anonymous clearly, you know, making public information which might have put individuals at risk did not operate under those same standards. And of course, what tools do you use? We generally don't think of the press as breaking in someplace to get information, and whereas Anonymous clearly is doing that. So I don't think it's an all black or white issue. I think it's hard to say that the revelation of much of the information hasn't been quite valuable. It's certainly been interesting. It's been covered by the press. At the same time, I would certainly stop short of endorsing either the way in which the information is collected or the pell-mell way in which it's been released by Anonymous.
Jordan, Apple has never come to the Black Hat event, but for the first time this year, they came. Why did they? What happened?
That's right. That may in what may be the biggest talk at Black Hat. An Apple security engineer is scheduled to present a talk today on some of the security technologies inside iPads and iPhones. And Black Hat's been going on 15 years. Apple was scheduled to present in 2008, and apparently the marketing department got wind of that and shut the talk down. Now there's nothing more scandalous at one of these conventions than a talk that doesn't happen. So that incident has kind of taken on, has been mythologized. And, you know, Apple's coming this year. Apple's had a series of attacks. There was an attack earlier this year that hit about 600,000 Macs. You know, every year there are various attacks on iPhones and the operating systems that run them. So for Apple, this is an acknowledgement that, you know, Apple products aren't hack-free. And that's going to be a significant talk. And the other point I wanted to make was that in writing these stories, that they're inevitably becomes a question of, well, what are you supposed to do as a consumer? There are a few tools that you can use. A, there are free credit reports. There are fraud alerts that you can set up. You can do online banking. You can check your account every day. Another interesting tip I got was that you can use two browsers on the internet, one for private data, one for kind of just general purpose browsing.
Jordan, I'm going to have to jump in here. We're running out of time. I appreciate everything you've done. Jordan Robertson, thanks for joining us. Jordan is a reporter for Bloomberg News. Michael Gregg, thanks for being here. Michael Gregg is a security expert for Superior Solutions. And Fred Kate, thanks as always. Fred Kate is director for the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.